Welcome, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. Today's show is going to be off the charts. We have three guests joining us today, but we're first starting off with my dating news of the week, which looks at a couple interesting dating sites that I came across this past week, followed by our Hollywood report. We're going to be getting into some really interesting stories about Joan Rivers and Michael Douglas. Then we're going to be talking to our first guest, Jenny Olson, who's a PhD candidate in marketing at the University of Michigan, about her findings on how savers may be sexy. I need to hear more about this. Then we're going to be talking to Alan Au, who owns a retail store for men in Los Angeles who tend to be shorter, men who are under 5'8". And we're going to talk with him about the challenges that shorter men find when dating. Then we're going to be talking to legal expert Dominic Rossetti about the difficulties associated with actually filing a divorce. Then we're going to end our show with my dating advice of the week. Don't go anywhere. Let's get into it. Okay, so in dating news this week, I came across this really interesting dating site. I'm into fantasy. I like movies about fantasy, especially love stories about fantasy. I mean, who doesn't love The Princess Bride? But when I'm dating online, I prefer that I'm dating in a more realistic setting. But apparently James Cameron has his hand in a dating site. Well, he doesn't actually have his hand in the site, but it seems as though he might, in fact, do so, because the dating site AlterDate.com essentially allows people to use avatars. Their motto is live fantasy and date virtually. Are people trying to essentially have some type of escape in an online dating setting? Would these people actually meet in real life? I think we need to look into this a little further. All right, another dating site that I came across. Sex on Demand. No, that's not the name of the site. Don't get me wrong. Don't Google sexondemand.com. It's the premise and mission of a new dating app called Pure App. So the people who are matched on this site are matched solely based on their sexual preferences and their geographic location. And essentially the goal of the site is, as I said before, to provide sex on demand. In fact, there was a recent video developed by the site that is essentially comparable to soft porn. And as a result, they've obviously seen a boost in traffic on the site. But the issue with this app, Pure App, is that they're arguing that human beings cannot really be monogamous. I would agree with you. Humans are not naturally monogamous. However, humans remain not monogamous for social support. We experience social pressure to be in a monogamous relationship. The founders of Pure App have it wrong when they say that monogamy is completely dead. When we look at changes that have happened over the past 50 years in the United States, such as the rise in cohabitation and divorce, we see that marriage still persists, especially for a segment of the population that is more stable with regards to their education and income. So marriage and monogamy to a certain degree must be more desirable for some reason. And the reason is that partners are the strongest social tie that individuals have in later life. Who's going to bake your macaroons? Who's going to take you to the hospital when you're sick when you're old? Not the individual who you meet on Pure App to have a 5-minute hookup, but the individual to whom you're married. While I think that the Pure App certainly meets a certain segment of the population, I certainly don't believe that it signals the death of monogamy. Maybe the Pure App user just isn't the same type of individual who's going to go on a site like Jaded or Match to find a long-term partner. So, people at Pure App, Dr. Jess says, you're wrong on this one. All right, everyone's a flutter. No, I'm not flying around the room and I don't have butterfly wings on. Although, when my first ballet recital, I was a butterfly at the JCC, and the song was I'm a Lonesome Little Butterfly, and I was very cute, and I fluttered around the room. But the fluttering I'm talking about today is Love Flutter. So Love Flutter is a new dating site. It started in Britain, and it was launched in New York this spring, and it's now expanding across the United States. It uses sort of this Google Graph model and actually links to your Facebook to try to match you with people on the basis of your interests. And I must tell you that I sort of found this to be annoying because I filled out the survey that they have, and I'll explain that more in a little bit, but they have the survey to determine whether or not individuals can be accepted to the site or not, called their quirky interest test. and you have to allow them to link to your Facebook. And I'm always reluctant to let people link to my Facebook page, although you should always be looking at my Facebook page, Hook Up with Dr. Jess. But they want to find out, what are you interested in on Facebook, and how does this relate to your compatibility with other people? And the premise of the site is that they will not accept everybody. So I wanted to know, okay, is Dr. Jess cool enough to be accepted to Love Flutter? So I filled out the survey, and I got 80%, and I was accepted to the site. So you might be asking yourself, what are some of the kinds of questions that they asked you? I thought the questions were kind of weird. They weren't the kind of normal dating questions you get, like, what would you do if you won the lottery? Or, you know, do you value friends and family? The questions were, what type of role would you take if you were in a band? What type of social media usage do you have? Would you go to the movies alone? And while these seem like really weird questions, I thought they were brilliant because these questions get at issues that people aren't thinking about. For example, the social media usage question, that tries to get at whether or not individuals are connected to other people. The question about, would you go to the movies by yourself? Which I, in fact, did this weekend, and I saw The Butler. It was excellent. I recommend you see it. That is trying to get at whether or not you're an independent individual. The question about what type of role would you have if you were in a rock band tries to get at, how do you see yourself in a group setting, and what type of role do you normally assume? So these are actually interesting questions that try to get at things that people aren't really thinking about. Then, after I was accepted and passed the quirky interest test, I actually went to fill out all their forms, and they asked me some basic things like, where do I live? And then they asked me for all of the usual demographic data that are asked on dating sites, like, what's your gender? What's your age? Do you smoke? Do you drink? The one thing that they didn't ask, which I think is important to ask on dating sites, is religion, because that's, we've talked about a lot on Hook Up with Dr. Jess. Religion is a very important factor by which individuals choose a prospective marriage and dating partner. So I would tell the Love Flutter people, if you're listening, add religion to your surveys. Also, the site's still in beta testing. So when I kept pressing the button to proceed to the next series of questions, it just stops. So I think that they're still having some technical glitches. So Love Flutter, I think you need to do a little bit of work, but otherwise, good job so far. Okay, so more money, more sex. This is an interesting premise, but I kind of agree, as do many listeners of Hook Up with Dr. Jess who sent me this story. So according to this recent study that was conducted in Britain, there's an association between the frequency with which individuals are getting it on and the amount of money they're earning. Kind of awesome. They're finding that married people are having more sex generally and that they're more likely to make more money. We've known this for a really long time, and the people who were conducting this study said that they believe that married individuals might be more social and more stable, which could contribute to their higher earnings. They also found that sex also is able to translate into good health outcomes, which obviously have an effect on how well you're working and performing at your job. So this is my take on it. Individuals who are more attractive make more money generally. This has always been the case. It's been empirically proven. In fact, the causes of this are that being more attractive leads to being treated differently and also therefore translate into your individual personality, for example, how confident you are. And I really think that this also would translate into dating generally. So when you're out on the dating market, if you're more confident, you're also more attractive and therefore more desirable as a mate. So I would be curious as to whether individuals who are more likely to marry and earn higher incomes also had higher incomes before they got married relative to people who were also single when they were single. All right, y'all, that's something to think about. We're going to play a bit of music and then be right back with our Hollywood report. Don't go anywhere. Welcome, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. We just had our dating news of the week, and now we're back with the Hollywood report. So there's a new bachelorette in town. No, she's not young, bold, or beautiful, but she's funny, older, and holds the strings to my heart. Yes, Joan Rivers. So there's this new web dating show that's come out with Joan Rivers called Romancing the Joan, which is, I guess, a play off Romancing the Stone, which is a 1980s movie with Michael Douglas, who we'll be talking about in a bit, and Danny DeVito. And I really, really think that this is an interesting premise for a series. Joan Rivers is 80 years old, and her daughter, I think, is very amused by the fact that she's actually going to be having her own reality dating show. I'm trying to think about some ridiculous reality dating shows that I've seen in the past. Like, there was the Omarosa dating show, which was absolutely insane, and there was also that dating show with Ocho Cinco, I think, on VH1. I mean, I don't know what Joan's thinking. She's so high class, and I can't imagine her doing this, but I certainly will be watching, and you'll be hearing about it more on Hook Up with Dr. Jess. Okay, on to Michael Douglas. As I said, I would not deny you Michael Douglas. As you know, he's one of my favorite actors, up there with Harrison Ford. And I was thinking about him this week because I watched Star Chamber, which is this wonderful 1983 movie where he's a judge and they actually meet with other judges to sort of decide new verdicts for criminals once they've already committed a crime. It was the first movie that my parents saw as a couple, so that has a lot of meaning for me, too. But I was thinking about this and talking to my mom and telling her, oh, Mom, I watched Star Chamber. It was so good. And she was like, oh, wow, I heard that Michael Douglas might be getting a divorce from his wife. And I thought to myself, oh, no, that's so terrible. We talk about Michael Douglas a lot on this show. We talked about him a couple weeks ago with Dr. Sarah, our medical expert, about his association between cancer and oral sex. And now we're going to talk about whether or not he's getting a divorce. Okay, so is it true? Are Michael and Catherine separating? Rumor has it they are. However, I'd like to report that they're not, or at least they're not publicly going to be announcing a divorce anytime soon. Friends close to the Douglases say that they've been living apart, but that's more for logistical reasons than anything else. Apparently, Catherine and Michael prefer the city and the country. So they're living in different places, but are still very happily married. According to Jones, they are really happy because they have a high level of respect and are willing to give each other a lot of space. I think that's really good advice for a marriage too, Catherine. Hope all goes well with you and Michael. Okay. Recent reports have Tesla Motors CEO and Cameron Diaz linked. But I don't think that's happening anymore, because today I read that Cameron Diaz and Jason Segel are now seeing each other. They were spotted together in the Hamptons, and the Bad Teachers co-stars, which is a great movie, by the way, are now seeing each other. They were spotted in a grocery store together, shopping. I love grocery stores. As I told you before on Hook Up with Dr. Jess, that's a great place to meet somebody, in the grocery store. Maybe Cameron Diaz, who hired Jane Fonda to be her dating coach, talked to her and she said, go to the grocery store and date funny man Jason Segel. I bet that's what Jane Fonda told her. So I think that there's a really interesting How I Met Your Mother story that could come up from Jason Segel and Cameron Diaz being together. I'll let you know more next week on Hook Up with Dr. Jess. All right, that was the Hollywood Report. We're going to play a bit of music and then get back with Jenny Olson. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. I'm excited to have Jenny Olson with us today, who's a PhD candidate at marketing at the University of Michigan, who's going to talk to us about some of her research on spending behavior and mate desirability. Welcome, Jenny. How are you today?
Hi, welcome. I'm doing really well, and I'm looking forward to kind of talking about some of my research.
Great. Looking forward to having you. So, you study whether or not saving or spending behavior is considered to be more desirable in a mate. And given that your research subjects had never met the individuals that they were evaluating, they were looking at online dating profiles when you were doing this, how did they go about determining whether or not an individual was a spender or a saver from just looking at this dating profile?
Oh, that's a great question. And so what we did in our specific studies is we created these mock profiles, and we told people that we asked these individuals a series of random questions, mm-hmm. and that they were going to be able to see the person's response to one of the selected questions. And the question always happened to be, how would you describe your spending habits? And so in our case, the people people always kind of self-identified as either a big saver or a big spender. And so it was never necessarily like people didn't have to infer it because they said what it was. Although in current research, we're trying to kind of figure out, you know, what are these visible manifestations of saving behavior? And like, how can you tell, you know, short of someone just flat out saying, I'm a saver and I'm a spender. So in our studies, we always had people kind of self-report what they were.
Absolutely. And, you know, what's really interesting is that if we think about spending and saving behavior, we often analyze it from a perspective of visual markers, you know, having a Ferrari or owning a large home. But in this case, there aren't these strong visual markers of saving to the same degree that there are for spending. So do you think that the lack of visual markers generally makes it more difficult for individuals to evaluate a prospective partner both online and offline in terms of this behavior?
Yes, I think that absolutely is the case. And I think that might be one reason why previous research hasn't really tackled this question of, you know, when is saving attractive and resource conservation in particular. Spending is obviously visual, and so a lot of evolutionary psychology kind of focuses on it because it's an easy, visible display of someone's resources. In terms of saving, since this is a work in progress, we're still kind of identifying these factors, but we're thinking, because our results really are driven by self-control and perceptions of self-control, if somebody, you know, kind of shows a little bit of restraint in different areas, that might be an indicator that he or she is more likely to be a saver. So, you know, if you go to their apartment and you notice they're kind of minimalistic and they have IKEA furniture, it could be an indication that they're more likely to be a saver rather than a spender.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. And you do find that people who are deemed to be savers are considered more desirable than spenders. And from what you just said, and I want to ask you rather than put words in your mouth, but why do you think that this is the case other than the fact that it's an ability to show restraint?
Right. So I think that there are both positive and negative attributes associated with different spending habits. So someone that says, I'm a spender, I mean, they could be attractive because someone might think, oh, generosity, but there's also this, like, irresponsible, wasteful, arrogant piece. Same thing with savers. I think, and as our research shows, it really is self-control, but it's also, you know, perceptions of being responsible and caring in a romantic relationship. And we think that this might kind of spread to other relationship patterns. So things like, you know, this person might be less likely to say hurtful things because they're better able to control their impulses, not just in the monetary domain, but these other domains as well, including health behavior. So, you know, they may be a little bit more fit because they're less likely to kind of indulge in that dessert. Not to say that, you know, indulging once in a while is problematic, but if someone consistently does that, you know, then that might kind of lead to negative health implications down the road. But we really think savers in general are more attractive because of, you know, these self-control attributes and the related qualities of things like responsibility.
Absolutely. I think that's a really good point. I think that one of the interesting points, though, about spenders versus savers is with regards to how they view relationships generally. For instance, somebody who is a saver, as you found in your study, is probably more forward-thinking. So they're more likely to think about goals in the relationship generally. Is this the type of person that I'd want to marry? Would I want to have a family with this person? They'd also have more of a capacity to execute that because presumably they've had the requisite resources saved to be able to afford a wedding, afford money to pay for a home, afford money to pay for children's college education in the future. So those are, you know, I think, very important qualities in a partner as well.
Oh, I think that's a fantastic point, and you're actually giving me research ideas
for
future studies in terms of thinking, like, you know, how do people can identify themselves with savers and spenders to actually review the relationship itself and kind of lay theories of relationships, like, you know, is it a partner really just somebody that you share resources with, or is this someone that, you know, you share other aspects of your life with? And I think that savers are indeed, they are perceived as more forward thinking. They're thinking longer term. They might be more favorable towards things like, you know, investing in a home and that, you know, also carries over to like investing in children and investing in a future together. It's also possible that savers might be more likely to engage in pro-relationship behaviors and have better communication skills. Although, you know, we haven't tested those things, but those are definitely great points.
Absolutely. I also wonder whether or not the present economic climate
over the past, you know, 5-6 years since the, you know, the Great Recession has influenced people's behavior and thinking regarding spending versus saving. So we obviously don't have retrospective data on this, but I wonder, you know, if 10 years ago the same type of mindset would have been as favorable for individuals with regards to being attracted to a saver versus a spender, because employment situations, even for the most highly educated, are now more precarious. So somebody might be more attracted to a saver so that if something does go wrong, that they're at least set financially for a period of time.
Absolutely. I think that is a great point, and I agree with you. I think that, I mean, ideally we could look at some of these patterns from a few years ago, but I think that the economic climate currently definitely has an impact on our findings. If we looked at more, you know, times of greater economic abundance, we might not find these things, because people might not be valuing saving to the same extent as they do during, you know, times of economic recessions and such. So I think we started this project a couple years ago when it, you know, the Great Recession was kind of at its height. So I definitely look forward to kind of continuing this line of work and seeing how it develops over time as the economy changes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you have so many really interesting ways that you could take this initial finding and spin it off to really find out how it relates to relationships more broadly. I think that's really interesting.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, as I talk to different people about this project, everyone, you know, brings up just great points and great different avenues to take this research. And I'm really hoping that, you know, we continue with this line of work and that other researchers do as well to really understand this phenomenon of, you know, why frugality and being thrifty is attractive in a partner.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm also curious, because I think we talk about online dating on this show so much, and I think that self-presentation is so critical when dating online. How would you recommend that individuals present themselves who want to be perceived in a positive light?
That's a great question. It was actually funny that you mentioned that, because one of our studies, we looked at self-presentation in an online dating context, and we find that people are more likely to say they're a saver than a spender, you know, when they're answering a profile question versus when they're just doing a private questionnaire. So I don't think necessarily that saying that you're a saver or a spender is the way to go about it, because you could be, you know, someone might actually be being faulty or not, or being deceptive. So I think that at the end of the day, it's important to just, you know, be yourself and be confident. And maybe, you know, if you want to be perceived as more of a saver, you can, you know, kind of convey different things about being responsible. So, oh, look, there's photos of my home that I just bought, you know, to kind of be like, I'm thinking longer term, I'm into investments. But at the end of the day, I just think it's, but I think at the end of the day, it's important to be yourself, and also maybe, you know, share some first date ideas, and those first dates might kind of signal that you're more of a saver. So if you, you know, suggest going to a thrift shop together and buying each other crazy outfits, you know, that's something that's a more affordable date. Likewise, you know, cooking dinner together at home, or trying a new adventurous cuisine together at home is also a way to save money. Also signal that, you know, maybe I really value being responsible with my finances.
Absolutely. And it's very interesting, because you think about, I'm thinking about the pictures that I see most often posted on online dating sites, and a lot of them are people going to very exotic locales. And that, I love traveling as much as the next person, but that involves a great deal of financial resources and a lot of spending, obviously. So it really, you're really showing where your priorities lie. You know, I theoretically could be putting $4,000 into an IRA rather than going to Europe for a couple weeks.
Oh, absolutely. And I think in one of our studies, we find that spending on experiential purchases is just as attractive as spending on an investment. I think that, but I agree, I mean, spending a lot of money on, like, flashy, luxurious vacations, like going on a cruise to the Mediterranean is, you know, there are ways that you can do that in a way that, you know, signals that I am more of a conscientious spender. So, you know, not going on all the excursions and maybe, you know, or doing a trip that's more about backpacking through Europe as opposed to these luxurious kind of things, or maybe a trip, you know, to Belize, or, you know, more of a mission-style kind of trip would also be valuable. But I think one of our studies is really interesting in that it points to that fact that, you know, maybe creating memories in an experiential sense is what is attractive, as opposed to, you know, saving to buy things like big screen TVs and Ferraris. So that materialism piece is not attractive, but, you know, being, you know, more open to investing in experiences is valued.
That's really interesting. Well, Jenny, thank you so much for being with us today, and I look forward to having you on in the future.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was very fun, and I look forward to kind of hearing what everybody thinks.
Great. All right, y'all, that was Jenny Olson with us today, talking with us about her research on spenders and attractiveness. We'll be playing some music, and then we'll be back with Alan Au. Don't go anywhere. Welcome, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. I'm excited to announce that we have Alan Au here with us today, who is the owner of a retail clothing store in Beverly Hills that caters to men who are 5'8" and under, as well as a fashion consultant. Alan, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. So, Alan, I was really curious to talk with you about how shorter men fare on the dating market. My listeners don't know this because they can't see me, but I'm barely 5'1", and I've really never perceived my height to be a disadvantage when I'm dating, but I understand that a lot of men who are shorter do feel like they're at a disadvantage. So do you think that shorter men are at a distinct disadvantage when dating?
I think many are. I can't say it's not fair to say all, but I believe for a lot of men it is, because I think a lot of women, not knowing exactly what they want from a guy, they go right away to finding someone who's, you know, tall, dark, and handsome. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very fair to say if you didn't know anything about somebody, you go to physical attributes, just like, you know, if I go look into a room, my eyes go toward a beautiful woman. I'm not surprised by that. So I think shorter men do have a slight disadvantage, because women are looking for someone generally taller than them. So there's definitely a disadvantage.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely true. But for a woman who is 5'1", or just barely 5'1", I can tell you that I don't think I'm as discriminating as women who potentially are taller. So a man who would be 5'8", or, you know, 5'6" is what I put on my online dating profile as, you know, my minimum height threshold. So theoretically, a man who is on the shorter side would be just fine with me. But for many women, even women who are shorter, do you think that's not the case?
I think for women, it's a different set of circumstances. One, you have a lot of heel options to change your height.
Sure.
And men don't look at women the same way. I think there are men who prefer women closer to their own height. There are men who love taller women, and then there are men who love petite women. But I don't get that same sense as far as women when they're looking for men. You know what I mean? So a guy who likes a woman who's like your height could be 5'6", he could be 6'6".
That's true. But I must tell you that I agree with you to a certain degree that men, regardless of their height, have a lot of variation in what they desire in women regarding their own heights. But I think that there are some women, even if they're not really, really tall, who do like guys who are actually tall. Like, I have one friend who's like 5'3", and she's like, I'm always looking for my gentle giant. So she doesn't want to date anybody who's not 6 feet or above. And logistically, you know, that's always been interesting. I mean, at prom, we went to prom, and her date had to stand on, like, a couple stairs below her for the pictures, and it was kind of funny. But it's something that people need to think about, I guess, a little bit more, because preferences are so interesting and so individual.
It's true, because sometimes a woman wants to feel petite, and it helps to find a taller guy to do that, right? And mm-hmm. for others, it's not as much of an issue, because I think, to some degree, if the guy's too tall, it's kind of hard to kiss him, right? To some degree.
Oh, yeah.
Waiting for a more taller heel, and yes, you have to have a few steps, got to reach for him. So there are some disadvantages, but people let that go because, you know, there's something desirable about finding a particular height as far as a guy's concerned, and it goes the same way for women too, right? So
Sure. And I mean, if we think about, you know, the evolutionary perspective, men who are taller are theoretically more genetically fit. So I think that's something that even subconsciously we have programmed in us to go for people who tend to be slightly taller as women.
Yeah, and it's one thing that a lot of people don't know, pound for pound, a 160-pound guy who's shorter is actually stronger than a taller guy.
I did not know this.
Yeah, so it could be somewhat of a misnomer. However, you feel safer with a bigger guy, right? You know, I think we are in this this time being safety conscious, you know, physical safety by being with a bigger guy. I think what's probably more important going back centuries, and, you know, nowadays, I think shorter men may have actually a better chance because women may be thinking more about financial safety or emotional safety versus physical safety because we don't live in that type of environment anymore.
No, absolutely. In fact, I think that my mother would be better in a fist fight than my dad, to be honest with you. But that's just me and my own opinion. But I was talking with one of, actually, our legal expert, Dominic Rossetti, and I was asking him about, you know, what things I should ask you because he found this topic to be really amusing. And he was curious about, in what context do you think men who are shorter perceive their height to be a disadvantage?
I think mostly when women reject them because mm-hmm. they see right away, oh, you know, you're not tall enough. I think I'll go talk to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
I think that especially if it happened when they were younger, if you didn't experience those negative reactions and rejections, say like as early as middle school on up through college, you may not have such a complex and concern about your height, and you just are a confident person because not everyone who's short has an issue with their height.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I was talking to a couple guys about this to try to think about it because I've never been a short man, so I don't know this. But one of the other men with whom I spoke said to me that he never really is conscious about his height when he's interacting with women, except when he's with, like, a group of people at a bar. Because when he's one-on-one with a woman, it's, like, totally natural and normal. But, like, when he's with a group of women or men at a bar, he feels as though the women are evaluating him relative to other men who potentially may be taller.
That, I think, makes a lot of sense, yes. I believe that does happen. And to some degree, it's not fair. But then again, there are things you can do to level the playing field a little bit.
Sure. So what do you think there are some things that men can do to improve their advantage in the market?
Well, in the case of your example, in a bar or a social setting like that, I think the way you dress plays a key role.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you enter a room and women see you, they don't know you. So the only thing they can do is evaluate you based on the way you look.
Sure.
And if you're not dressed appropriately, the tendency for a shorter guy is that they look shorter. So if you say buy the wrong size suit and you walk in, you're going to look smaller from a distance than you would your height. The goal isn't to, like, for example, I'm 5'6". I just want to look my best 5'6". All right. If I'm wearing a ill-fitting suit, I'm going to look shorter from a distance. I want to walk in looking my best so that when a woman does see me, it's not going to be like, oh, look how small he is. It should be, oh, look how well-dressed he is.
Absolutely. Okay.
And that takes away some of that stigma. You know, I think dressing well is really key. Some of the key tricks, I think, that's important is that, one, you want to wear a suit that fits well or a sports shirt or whatever it is that you want to wear out. Make sure it fits really well so that you don't look like you borrowed your older brother's clothes.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I think it's important that you choose patterns and styles that are flattering in proportion to your size. Sometimes guys think the best way to get attention is to grab a loud shirt, and sometimes it works to your disadvantage. You want to wear something that's interesting, but to scale so it fits your frame. You know, it
Absolutely.
Could look a little more subtle from far away, but perhaps more interesting in a conversational distance.
Oh, absolutely. As a woman who's very short, I've learned to what I can and cannot wear as well, and I think that's absolutely true. So men, go see Alan at his store in Beverly Hills and find the right clothes to fit you. Alan, thank you so much for being with us today. I really, really appreciate it and getting your perspective.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. All right, lovers and friends, that was Alan Au, who gave us his perspective on how short men can improve their stance in the dating market. I'm going to play a little bit of music, and then we'll be back with Dominic Rossetti. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. Today, we're joined by our legal expert, Dominic Rossetti, to talk about divorce and how it might not be as simple as certain dating sites are claiming it to be. Welcome, Dominic.
Hi, Jess.
How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. I'm excited to have you on. So, we were talking earlier this week about this article I saw about a dating site offering free divorces, and I really couldn't believe that SugarDaddy.com will be offering free divorces to three individuals in certain metro areas throughout the U.S. as part of a contest. I mean, the idea of this site doing this is sort of laughable. They're facilitating divorces when they're supposed to be facilitating relationships. Don't you think that they could face some type of liability for encouraging divorce among couples?
It is a little ironic, right, that a site that's supposed to be supporting dating is pushing divorce, but as far as liability goes, not really. There's a handful of states that still retain a sort of old common law tort, which is alienation of affection, which is pretty much what it sounds like. If somebody induces you as a married partner into a relationship outside of the marriage, they can be found liable. This tort's not really widespread. It's big in a couple states, particularly North Carolina. There seems to be a lot of activity still, but even in this situation, it doesn't seem likely that you'd be able to find Sugar Daddy liable for inducing someone out of a marriage. It's just a service that they're offering, not really seduction so much. So,
oh, yeah.
Probably not.
Okay.
But it raises some interesting issues at the very least.
Oh, absolutely. So, Dominic, this alienation of affection issue is really interesting. And we've talked about before my fascination with Lifetime movies. But I remember watching a Lifetime movie in which a woman sued the mistress of her husband and ultimately received money from the courts.
It's probably, there's a pretty famous case in North Carolina where a woman sued.
That might be it.
I mean, it was within the last 5 years. And yeah, she won a $9 million judgment against her husband.
Oh, my God.
Kind of startling, but, I mean, given this root has origins in sort of, like, women as property and a different concept of marriage as we sort of currently have. So it's really a throwback into history, but for whatever reason, a couple states are still holding on to it.
Interesting. Well, I mean, the women as property thing certainly bothers me as a sociologist and as a woman generally, but it seems as though this woman, by suing her husband, was actually turning the script and the law on its toes by employing it to actually receive financial benefit herself.
That's totally right. The property concept is really a woman is property as a chattel,
yes,
you call it, in old legal terms. But there's this one, and then there's criminal conversation, which is another tort that you don't really hear about much anymore. In the West Coast, it's usually typically a Southern thing.
Okay.
But that's just really, criminal conversation is just that. It's conversing sexually outside of your relationship with somebody else, and you can be found liable for each and every instance of sexual contact with somebody outside of your relationship. Again, not too prevalent, but still there. Still fun to talk about.
Oh, interesting. Well, for listeners who don't know this, Dominic and I went to Emory together, so the next time we're down in Georgia visiting our school, we're going to look around for alienation of affection and criminal misconduct. Is that what you said?
Criminal conversation.
So we're going to be on the lookout the next time we're in next time we're down south, we're going to be on the lookout. Okay, so Dominic, I was really curious. We normally don't think of divorces, though, as being quite as quick and simple as they're purporting it to be for SugarDaddy.com. Is that correct? I mean, I'm not unclear on this.
I'm going to give you my lame lawyer answer like I tend to do. I feel like almost every show, it really depends. I mean, if you're Warren Buffett and Wendy Chen, I think that's her name, it's going to be more complicated. There's more assets involved. There's more twists and turns. You don't know what's going to happen with assets going down the line to children and currently held assets and ones that are growing and ones that certain people control. So, I mean, if you've gotten married in the the last year and you're 19 years old and you have $50 in your bank account and a car payment and no debt, it's not as complicated. So it really just depends. There's a whole spectrum of complicated things that could be going on with a divorce and with the two parties. So whether or not it's simple or complicated is really not a fair question.
It's mostly dependent on the assets. But for Warren Buffett's...
It really depends on the people.
Yes, but for Warren Buffett's wife's sake, I don't know if you're listening, Mrs. Buffett, but it's actually Rupert Murdoch and Wendy Deng. I don't want to get you upset with Warren, Mrs. Buffett.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Not Warren Buffett. He's such a nice man.
He is, and if his wife's listening, we don't want to worry about her about this. Okay, so Warren...
Sorry.
So that's okay, but Rupert and Wendy are definitely splitting soon. But my next question...
That'll be a fun one.
Yeah, absolutely. But so it's basically just dependent on your assets. But we even think about the varying assets that most American couples have, and the average cost of divorce is still $15,000 in the United States. How is it possible that LegalZoom.com is only charging $300 for a quick and dirty divorce?
Well, you can buy a lot of things cheap, and you usually get what you pay for.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that a divorce should cost $15,000, but $3,000 is a little low by any standard. Lawyers are greedy, so 15 to me seems like it could be an inflated sort of price, but 300 is still low. Usually what you're looking for is a document that's tailored, or a resolution that's tailored to your particular circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
The lawyer should be looking at what you've got and what your husband's got, and maybe, or what your wife has, or maybe your situation with your children, and trying to anticipate any problems that would come down the line.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're paying for, and then to make sure that everything's tied up neatly and tightly and legally, so that in 5 years you're not going to find yourself in more trouble than you were at the start of the divorce. So it's usually better to get good coverage on the front end rather than trying to patch it up down the road, because you're going to end up paying more.
That's true. So if you buy the Honda, you're not going to be getting the Ferrari in a couple years.
That's right.
Got it. I understand. So, what exactly is involved, though, in a divorce? I mean, my parents have been happily married for 30 years. I'm not at all really familiar with, you know, how a divorce contract really works. I mean, we talked about that there's a separation period before. How does a divorce work exactly?
So, you should think of a divorce as a dissolution of marriage. A marriage, really, legally, notwithstanding all the cultural connotations and things, is really just a contract.
Got it.
It's an agreement between two people, creates all these rights and obligations between the two people, affecting property and how it can be held and distributed, and what you do with your children, and all sorts of issues that can arise out of a marriage. A divorce, you should think of as the end of that agreement, as the end of that contract.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, you want to tie it up as neatly as possible, and you want to make for all your bases in the divorce, so that when you've got to deal with this division of property, possibly alimony, child support, and child custody, that you know what's going on and your interests are adequately represented through the divorce. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. So essentially, if I ever get divorced, and I told you on prior shows that I'm convinced that my husband will be unfaithful to me. So if my husband is unfaithful to me and I decide to divorce him and take him for all he's worth, or as Ivanka Trump said, don't get mad, get everything. Or Ivana, it was Ivana. Ivana's the mother. Ivana, I don't want to say anything about Ivanka because she's very happily married to, I think his name's Jared Kushner. He's very attractive, as is his brother Josh, in case he's listening. She said, don't get mad, get everything. And I completely agree with her. So if I don't want to get mad and get everything, I should definitely have my own lawyer.
I would definitely get your own lawyer. That should be unstated assumption. If you're going to go through a divorce, it would be a very silly move not to get a lawyer.
Okay.
For sure.
Okay, well, in a couple years...
Like going to a knife fight without a knife.
Well, I'm somewhat of a pacifist, so I might not go into a knife fight with a knife. I might try to just reason them.
Well, I mean, I shouldn't say that. A lot of people can amicably resolve their issues with just one lawyer or a mediator or, you know, something simple.
Yeah.
Not every divorce is a knife fight.
That's true.
Many are, but they don't need to be.
That's true. You bring up an interesting point. I don't think about this often, but people often do use mediators to try to have a divorce.
There's lots of amicable settlements that go along. The problem with that is, a lot of times, I mean, I tend to do a lot of fighting in court. I've been litigating and doing criminal stuff, so I only see the ugly stuff.
Got it.
You don't really get to look at the fun stuff, like the clean things as a lawyer. When somebody sets something up and they use one lawyer and a mediator, what I end up seeing is 5 years down the road is that somebody feels aggrieved. They feel like they weren't adequately, you know, they didn't get what they deserved and now they want it. So we're fighting over a five-year-old document that wasn't done very well.
Got it.
But we should encourage people to try and end things smoothly and nicely.
All right. Well, Dominic, thank you so much for being with us today. As always, it was a pleasure.
Maybe you just.
All right, guys, that was Dominic Rossetti, our legal expert, talking with us about divorce. I'm going to play a bit of music and then get back with my dating advice for the week. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. We were just talking with legal expert Dominic Rossetti about divorce, and now I'm going to give you my dating advice of the week. Okay, this dating advice is sort of fun and interesting because it's a take off of an article I saw this week about dating advice from the 1930s. And as an individual whose grandparents were teenagers in the 1930s, I think this is something that's really interesting to think about. How did my grandparents date, or how were they socialized to date? So one of the bits of advice that was given is that people should not do tea time. Apparently, the author of the message, Don't Do Tea Time, said men don't like to make house calls, and men are also bored at tea. Well, I'd like to turn that advice on its head now in the 21st century. I think a date with tea is an absolutely wonderful idea. I always talk about how drinks are an audition for dinner, and while I don't think you should necessarily go for tea on your first date, I think tea is a good idea following your first date because it really gets the chance for you to try to talk to an individual and get to know them in the light of day. I always say a woman wants to get to know a man in the daylight. She's going to get to know him in the nightlight, but it's important that she likes him in the daylight first. So tea is that perfect opportunity. You get to go to hopefully a nice hotel where they have formal tea, or high tea as it's called at most nice restaurants or hotels, have desserts, and sit there out in a nice area, talk, get to know each other, and enjoy a bit of tea together. It's kind of like going to Britain, but you're in the middle of the United States. That's my dating advice of the week. Come back next week for more with Hook Up with Dr. Jess. Remember, lovers and friends, don't fake it.